May I ask you to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Brent Burchett. I'm Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau.
Okay, great. And you're relatively new in this role?
I have a little bit of accent, Grant, if you can't tell. I moved from Kentucky this past year. Love San Luis Obispo. Love the weather and just a really great community to be in.
And did you come out for the job at the Farm Bureau?
I did. My fiancée, Kyle Twisselman, is from San Luis Obispo. Her family still ranches out in Creso Plain. So we thought we'd come give California a try. Didn't really know what to expect in terms of California agriculture. I knew California is the largest agriculture state in the nation, and so I was pretty excited just to see what type of agriculture you all grow crops there that we don't have in Kentucky. A lot of the leafy greens and strawberries and avocados, and so it's been neat for me just as a farm kid myself. My family raised corn and soybeans, wheat and tobacco in Kentucky, and you all don't grow those crops here, so my agronomic knowledge is pretty worthless when I came out here. But luckily I've had some good Farm Bureau members kind of help tutor me and make sure I understand the crops, and the regulations are certainly a lot more intense. It's a challenge, and I think here Farm Bureau has a more pronounced role maybe than other states that are more laid back, less regulations. But here, just for context, the entire state of Kentucky does about $5 billion or $4.5 billion of crop and livestock sales each year. And this single county of San Luis Obispo has $1 billion in crop and livestock sales. So the counties of Kentucky are a lot smaller. And so when I told people I was coming to California to work for a county farm bureau, they said, "Oh, did something happen? You know, like it was a bad thing." I said, "No, this is a really big county. This is like a fourth of the size of Kentucky, and such a huge agriculture driver for your local economy." And I've enjoyed it and don't enjoy those gas prices, a little bit cheaper in Kentucky.
Yeah, you were saying $2.
Yeah, $2 change. Gosh. And I've enjoyed it, and I think this will give me a good perspective on what's to come nationwide for agriculture. A lot of trends we see, whether it's, you know, positive things like new technologies or more challenges like regulations, oftentimes they start here in California and they work their way east.
What were some of the biggest things that you had to learn when you stepped into this job?
So just understanding all the different regulatory agencies that impact farming. In Kentucky, for example, if you want to dig a pond on your property to water your cows, that's a pretty easy thing to do, not a lot of paperwork. And here there's a lot more environmental standards, which is certainly a thing to be proud about in California. I think what the disconnect comes in is regulations that certainly sound good and have very much positive intentions. No one really sees how that is enforced. They don't see the paperwork. And wherever you go, I know people support small family farms. They support the idea that you can be make a living from farming just with you and your family. But that is increasingly difficult. And we talk about big agriculture. A lot of people don't like the idea of corporate-owned farms. But when you have water quality paperwork, when you have water quantity paperwork, when you have pesticide regulations, when you have food safety regulations, it takes a lawyer to read some of these things. And I don't consider myself a stupid person, but when I look at some of the paperwork that's required here of farmers, you can see why a lot of farmers throw their hands up and say, I can't do this anymore.
Can you give us an example of some regulation that to take away, it would be a lot better for farmers?
Sure. One in particular we're concerned about is from the Central Coast Water Board, which is dealing with water quality. The goal is important and noble, and that is to limit the amount of nitrogen that runs off in ag water from these fields. So when a farmer turns on those sprinklers, those drip irrigation systems, how much of the fertilizer that's either in the soil or being applied to the plant, how much of that is going into the waterways? And certainly that's a bad thing if you have excess nitrogen levels out in the waterways. Those can accumulate and cause health impacts, but I think one of the initial goals is to better understand, it's called ag order. It has the potential to limit literally the amount of crops you could have in a field. If the standards are set a certain way, if the testing requirements are done in a way that really only a large farmer could comply with that. So I think it's a unforeseen consequence that when you have a well-intentioned regulation, whether it's water quality or Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which is water quantity. That's a new thing for our county. That's a new thing for California as a whole. So my very first, I think, regulatory meeting was actually a Sustainable Groundwater Management Act meeting in Paso Robles. And it was like a knife fight, Greta. It was very intense, and everyone was very contentious. And of course, I'm still ignorant on the local issues and the players involved. Here you have a very expensive agriculture industry because of these regulations and because you have limited natural resources. The reason California agriculture is what it is today, it's because you have perfect growing conditions. You have great sunny weather. You have a longer growing season. You can have multiple crops per year. But if you don't have water, if you don't have access to labor, those advantages are negated. So I think long term, people in the ag industry think that California may not be as good as it is today in agriculture from an economic leader perspective, just because the, you know, we don't foresee regulations being rolled back. We see those to continue to be more scrutinized. And I think farmers are just getting to a point where, is it really worth trying to make a living doing this? I think there's frustration that when you go to the state capitol, there's kind of an antagonistic view of what are farmers doing wrong? What can we do to further restrict them? And you've got the normal difficulties in farming, which are weather variations, market fluctuations. When you add the regulations on top of that, it can be pretty cost prohibitive and make people say, I can't make a living farming.
Gosh, I'm feeling downhearted because I'm one of those people that I want farmers, small farmers too.
Everyone does.
Well, so what can we do? I mean, what do you work at every day?
So Farm Bureau, just for background, is a voluntary membership organization. We're not a government entity. We are entirely driven by our members. So my salary is paid for by membership dollars. When you join the San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau, you're also a member of the California Farm Bureau Federation, which is our statewide organization. You're also a member of the American Farm Bureau Federation. Now, do all those groups align on all policy issues? Absolutely not. All those policies are driven by members. So this past December, SLO County farmers went to Monterey for our statewide Farm Bureau meeting and spent a lot of days. And it's pretty painful. Imagine a room full of 100 farmers trying to wordsmith specific policy recommendations. But that is the strength of Farm Bureau. It's that if the farming community, for instance, doesn't like a ag worker housing bill that's before the assembly, the reasons we don't like it are detailed pretty explicitly by the members. And that helps us be a true grassroots organization. We have members that are growing 1 acre of crops. We have members that grow on 1,000 acres of crops. If you get a room full of farmers together, they won't agree on much. And so it's a challenge. If you choose not to join Farm Bureau, we're still going to advocate on your behalf. But in the big picture, we're losing farmers. We're having farmers age out and retire and pass away. Who's going to grow our food? We think of, well, we can just import this food, but that's really not what we want. That's kind of something we don't think about in terms of national security. If we have to depend on other nations to grow our food, we're beholden to them in a sense, and it's a big deal. We'll talk some more about trade, and there's been some positive movements on that front. But my takeaway is that Farm Bureau is so important. Even if you're not a full-time farmer, we have a lot of associate members. We have a lot of businesses here in San Luis Obispo that are directly dependent on farmers' success. So they want to see favorable regulations. They want to see markets develop. They want to see that our local elected officials or Economic Vitality Corporation, your chambers of commerce, that they think of agriculture as a key part of the business community. But it's also, we're not just making cell phones and computers here. We have to eat. You know, it's something we can't do without.
Pretty necessary. Okay.
Pretty necessary. So we have two things on the trade front. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, that is probably the biggest, most important trade bill, specifically for California and San Luis Obispo. Mexico and Canada are markets we cannot do without. So if you're familiar with under Bill Clinton's administration, they passed the North American Free Trade Act, or agreement, I should say. USMCA is replacing NAFTA, and it was when President Trump came into office, there was talk of immediate repeal of NAFTA. Well, farm groups said, that's a big mistake. Don't do that. It's okay to change NAFTA. Let's have new negotiations, but let's keep NAFTA on the books and then supplant it with a new policy that'll make sense for the United States and for Mexico and Canada. And so that's a positive thing. On the Chinese front, there was a phase one deal announced, and that's more relevant to, like, my family in Kentucky raises soybeans. About half of our soybeans are exported to China. So the loss of that market was devastating. California, we are growing food that is for the most part consumed in North America. We do have some pretty good markets in Japan and other countries. But in terms of big trade deals, USMCA is the much bigger thing for San Luis Obispo farmers.
How exactly is that going to affect us? So I know our big crops here are strawberries, broccoli, wine grapes.
You got
so
it,
how does that going to affect us, the new trade agreement?
So And just to give you the top list, this is from our San Luis Obispo County Agriculture Commissioner's Office, who does an annual basically crop report to kind of detail what the top crops are. Wine grapes, number one, that's about 26% of the county's portfolio. Strawberries is a very close second, 25%. Broccoli would be about 4.5%. Avocados, 4.5%. Cattle, about a little over 4%. But also think about vegetable transplants. Think about there's a really good farm here that does starters, little plugs. So we have a pretty neat, diverse ag industry. Think of the cut flower market, also lemons, pretty diverse industry. So if you're a farmer, you want to have multiple crops. That way you are insulated from this volatility we see in the market. For us here, though, the trade that will be most important, I think, will be on those vegetable items. And certain parts of the country may export crops to a certain area, but they're all in the same market in that if there is a huge demand in Mexico for lettuce, let's say none of our San Luis Obispo lettuce farmers sell their lettuce to Mexico, but having that market here in California now increase because now more of those Monterey or Salinas Valley grown crops are going to Mexico, that drives up our market too. So that's a positive. So when we look at who are our trade partners, That's a piece of it, but look at the big picture of anytime we have more trade, that's more demand, and that's going to help all markets across the country and here in California.
What exactly does it say? Does it say we're not going to charge you any money to bring a crop in here?
Pretty much. It's a series of tariffs and the things that we would have. There's still some tariffs, I'm sure, in this USMCA deal. There's still going to be restrictions, but it also ties into labor practices. So a big piece for a lot of Democrats in Congress was that Mexico adhere to a higher worker standards for safety and wages. That way all of our jobs are not won't be as prone to be going down to Mexico and lose those markets like manufacturing. So it's not just agriculture that's involved in these trade deals, but it also puts stability. So if I'm a farmer, I can deal with maybe a tariff of 10-15%. Maybe I can work that into my cost calculations. What I can't do is make an investment in a crop that I don't know what the conditions are going to be a year out in terms of government regulations, in terms of quotas. There was talk earlier in 2019 of actually closing the Mexico border. That would have been devastating for our farmers here, both on the labor front and on the ability to access those markets. So trade deals kind of normalize things. They affirm the rules of the road going ahead, saying what the agreements can be between a company in California and a company in Mexico, whether we're importing the crop or whether we're exporting it to Mexico. And I think for farmers, they want to see stability. They were proud that USMCA got ahead. That's going to be a positive going forward, and we'll see more stability in the markets. Does that mean everything's going to be rosy? Absolutely not. But we talked about all those variables earlier, the weather, the labor. We don't want the marketing and the trade situation to be another variable.
For instance, I'll go to a grocery outlet, and I will see asparagus that says grown in Mexico, and I'll see a bunch of asparagus that says grown in California. I will always choose the one in California because I think of pesticides. I just have this idea that they use a lot more pesticides in Mexico. Is that, dispel me of any illusions,
well,
or am I correct in this? Or
you may be correct. There are certain deals that require a similar rules and regulations for crops brought into the United States. So, for example, when you see certified organic parsley, and it came from Mexico. The organic certification rules are the same for Mexican farmers as they are the United States farmers. There is some variability on regulation. I'm not certain on pesticide residue levels, but my understanding is most times those are going to be the same. Now, does that mean that a farmer in Canada used the same environmentally friendly practices and water sustainability as a farmer in California? Maybe not. That's a fair question. And my rule is I always try to shop as local as I can, whether that's hyper-local at the farmer's market where you can, you know where their field is down the road from your house. But really, this region and California as a whole is hugely dependent on other states demanding our crops. So if everyone in Kentucky said, I'm only going to eat Kentucky food, well, they would have a very limited, you know, selection at the grocery store. So it's to everyone's benefit to be open to trade. At the same time, we have to balance and know that we can support our local farmers here. That's a good thing. Those dollars will keep getting circulated in the local community. On the other side, there are local farm families that depend on other states and other nations purchasing our food grown here.
Let's talk about farm labor because it, you know, it just seems so backwards to me that we make it so hard. People who are working in the fields are, you know, for the most part, they're, correct me if I'm wrong, but undocumented workers. I don't see a big demand of people, you know, clamoring for those jobs.
You're absolutely right in that we mentioned the labor piece earlier. If we don't have these workers, it doesn't matter how great our soil is and our weather is and our, you know, expertise of our farming industry here. A lot of these crops are hand harvested. And I think in the big picture, you'll continue to see an increased move to mechanization. If I'm a farmer, the labor piece is so volatile that if I could put more certainty in that by purchasing a piece of equipment, I'm going to do that just because I can work it on my balance sheet. I can finance that off. If I've got a field of strawberries that might gross me $20,000-$30,000, but I can't get my workers the day that I need them to pick that crop, it's worth $0. You know, you have that loss. Or maybe I displace or I choose to harvest one crop over another, even though I need to harvest both of them because I can't get enough workers. I hear the comment that why don't you just pay more for workers and you would have more Americans that would necessarily want to work in there. And farmers have done that. The wages for farm workers are in often instances a lot higher than minimum wage. If you compare that to some other industries, farming is hard. You know, there's a reason I'm not out there picking strawberries. It's hard back-breaking work. It's challenging here because we have not historically used the H-2A, which is a federal guest worker program that allows workers to come for so many months of the year. They return to Mexico or wherever they're from, and that doesn't work for industries like dairy where they have year-round needs for workers. There has been more of an emphasis on, I believe you had a Bracero program, which going back, I don't know much about that, Greta. You educate me on that.
I've only seen when I drive down the 101, it says the Bracero Highway.
Yeah.
And it was in the 40s and 50s, and it was the guest worker where it made it a lot easier for Mexican workers to come here.
And I know a lot of the changes done for bringing in workers have been for good reason. No farmer wants to have this instance where workers are not protected. They have unsafe living conditions. So don't get me wrong. A lot of these changes have very much justification, but whenever we use the H-2A program, that's another layer of paperwork. And so I think the preference has been here to use farm contractors. So if I'm a farmer and I have a field ready, I call a contractor and he goes out and rounds up all the labor that can come out there to my field that day. Those workers are not employed by me. They're employed by the contractor and I pay the contractor and they pay them. But there's challenges to that because that's an open market. You have to compete for those workers. Let's say we get everything perfect, though, in terms of getting workers here, streamlining our federal immigration process, which I doubt we're going to do anytime soon. We should put a quick plug in for Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which is a bipartisan bill that has a tough way to go in the U.S. Senate. It's an instance where that legislation was backed by California Farm Bureau Federation and a lot of Western states that are more dependent on migrant labor. But it was opposed in my home state of Kentucky, the Kentucky Farm Bureau, and a lot of Southern states.
Why?
Because it had a pathway to citizenship for some workers. And so in Republican circles, I guess it's considered a dirty word to have that pathway to sit. They think of it as amnesty, and that's a political issue. So that's an instance where even among the American Farm Bureau Federation, you have your largest ag state, California, saying, we need this. This is the best possible compromise we can get on this issue to move forward. But other states, they don't have that same challenge. And so they're able to say, we don't like the idea of this pathway to citizenship or amnesty. So that's been frustrating for me because I see that the consequences of that firsthand when you have workers that don't have stability about the farmers don't have stability of knowing where their next workers are going to come from. And until we get some sort of federal solution on this, it's really just a Band-Aid on the problem. We need comprehensive immigration reform. And you'll hear everyone say that, Republicans, Democrats, Independents. But how much are we willing to compromise? Can we be realistic about what it takes to grow food in this country? And I can remember when the H-2A program started in Kentucky, one of the requirements is that you advertise all your farm worker jobs in the local newspaper so that Americans get first dibs, so to speak, on those jobs. And I can remember when my dad would, every now and then there'd be someone that would call in and say, yeah, I want to come help work tobacco. And he would say, okay, well, the interview is going to be at 5 a.m., you know, Saturday morning, and nobody showed up, you know. It's a hard thing. And just, you know, for, in my opinion, for worse, this society, we've decided that those jobs are beneath us. And You know, I grew up working in the fields, and I think it's a good thing that kids need to do to learn that how hard it is to grow food. And before you throw away, you know, a loaf of bread or something, like, well, there was a lot of work.
Absolutely.
Put into that.
I mean, I just find just having my own kitchen garden, you know, I know how hard it was for me to grow that little head of lettuce. So I am very cognizant of any kind of waste.
Yes. And I had a lady that was kind of critical of a lot of the practices on today's family farms. And she said, I don't think you should have the right to use pesticides and fertilizer. And I said, well, I understand that perspective, but I want you to try to raise your own food just to feed yourself this next year. And, you know, people can do that, but that becomes their full-time job, and they may not always have a guaranteed harvest. You could have crops and insects and disease pressure. And so I think when you see the other side, and I had another guy that said, I don't want to buy any food that the farmer made a profit on. And I had to laugh at that one.
Oh, my goodness.
Because, I mean, we're not a – if you can't get a return on your investment, you can't build that next, you know, barn or do the equipment you need or buy the livestock you need to have a farming operation. And I think we're just a little bit divorced from reality, especially here in California, about, you know, what it takes. When you see all these fields out here, you think, oh, it's a pretty field that should be a park, not a privately owned farm. Well, the farmer's paying taxes on that. The farmer's keeping that land up. It's and farmers get very emotional and sensitive about their land when there's these outside critics. And I certainly know that there no farmer is perfect, and we always have opportunities to improve. But in general, farmers want to leave the land better than when they found it. That's part of their legacy. And when I hear California farmers say, I would love to move out of here, but this was my granddaddy's land. This was where I want my kids to be able to farm and ranch. And, you know, it kind of pulls at your heartstrings, and it makes you feel that agriculture is a special industry, and it's something that we have to think of not just as another economic driver. It's really part of our viewshed, what makes Slo County a neat place to live and work. And just imagine if all those fields you see, you know, driving down LOVR, wherever you are in the county, imagine if those were all houses, or if those were all, you know, unkept parks. Well, now the government has to pay for that land, and it's more of an ongoing expense. We have farmers are able to use land to inject money into our economy, to provide jobs. And just for context, we had a great economic impact report that came out just actually the end of 2019. And we mentioned earlier that Slo County produces $1 billion in crops and livestock. But if you take all the economic multipliers from what that gross revenue brings in to the county, agriculture in this county alone has a $2.5 billion economic impact that supports over 13,000 jobs. And that's something we should be proud of. That's something we have to account for when we're making economic decisions about land use and what should our priorities be as a county to grow. Agriculture is a special thing. And California, we're actually about the top 15th, 14th or 15th, depending on the measure, in terms of total ag production. And you're in a state that leads the nation. So Slo County has a very outsized presence in the ag community nationwide. And I think when you're here, you take it for granted.